Nice. So what I wanted to do today was give kind of an overview of fault-tolerant quantum computation, in particular what I see as kind of the biggest trends so far in the 21st century, with maybe a bit of a preview of what I think is to come later in the 21st century. So to start with, this is really a talk about quantum computation. And so a quantum computer, of course, is something that's in progress experimentally, but there's a lot of theory around it as well, which is, suppose you could build a computer out of individual atoms or other very small objects that behave in a quantum mechanical way. Then instead of having, a regular computer has bits, which are 0 and 1, a quantum computer has qubits, quantum bits, which can be 0, 1, or some superposition of them. You also get, complicated entangled states. And the point of doing this is that in addition to all the regular classical algorithms that you run on a regular classical computer, they can still run on a quantum computer. But you also have some additional quantum operations that allow you to run some algorithms that are non-classical and can solve some problems potentially exponentially faster than any classical computer. So this is a computer that has the possibility to solve some problems which are currently intractable, even assuming a couple more generations of Moore's law to make our computers even faster. So of course, the standard examples of those are factoring large numbers or simulating quantum systems. OK, so what I'm going to focus on is not what you can do with a quantum computer, but how you build one. In particular, how do you deal with errors? So a quantum computer, or a quantum algorithm, is going to be made up of kind of the smallest possible steps of computation, which are called quantum gates. And the problem is that a quantum gate in the real world is not going to be perfect. Of course, this is true of classical computers, too. The individual classical gates that make up your classical programs are not perfect either. But it turns out the error rates are so incredibly low that you don't have to worry about it in practice, unless you're running a really, really, really huge computation. Software errors, bugs in your program, that's a much bigger problem. That's a totally separate issue. But qubits are probably not going to be as reliable as classical bits. In fact, nowhere near as reliable. And there's kind of two reasons for that. So one is a problem that's already kind of starting to afflict classical computers, which is that as you make your components smaller and smaller and smaller, they're more and more delicate, right? It takes a smaller and smaller hit to change the state. Okay, so even classical computers are starting to have to worry about hardware error rates. And quantum computers, the components are even smaller, right? Like maybe single atoms. And so they're just that much easier to knock out of the correct state. But beyond that, quantum states are just inherently more delicate than classical information. Why is that? Well, so classical information, all that can go wrong is a bit flip. 0 goes to 1, 1 goes to 0. Quantum states have more things that can go wrong. They have superpositions, right? You can have 0 plus 1 go to 0 minus 1. But moreover, any kind of observation of a quantum state, a measurement, will collapse a superposition, right? And that will just make it like a classical bit. That's no good for quantum computation. And it doesn't have to be a person that's observing it. It can be a measuring device. It can be, an atom that just happens to be wandering by and interacts a little bit with this qubit, learning some information about its state. That atom becomes entangled, and when you look at your qubit, it now seems to have decohered. It's collapsed. Okay, and that sort of thing is very hard to stop. I mean, of course, experimentalists work very hard to do that, but they're never going to get it to the incredibly low error rates that we can see on classical computers. So in order to build a big quantum computer, we're going to need some way to deal with these errors. So the first step in that is the idea of a quantum error-correcting code. So in quantum error-correcting code, it's easiest to talk about it in a communications context. So we have two people, Alice and Bob. And Alice wants to send some qubit to Bob. But the communication channel has errors in it, has noise. So if she just sends it to Bob, there's some reasonable chance, non-negligible chance, that Bob will get the wrong thing. So how does she handle this? Well, the idea is to bring in additional qubits and to encode the qubit that she wants to send, or the qubits if there's many of them, in a quantum error correcting code using these extra qubits. You create some entangled state, and I'm not going to tell you the details of how quantum error correcting codes work. That's a totally different talk. But the idea is she creates some entangled states using these extra qubits. And now the information is kind of spread out. And moreover, there's certain constraints on this information so that if there's an error along the way, which of course there could be, Bob has some procedure he can do at the end here, a decoding procedure, that will identify what the error is, correct it, and then he's able to extract the qubits that Alice intended to send him. And they're much more reliable. Of course, nothing is perfect. The error rate is probably some sort of random process, and if there happen to be more errors than you're expecting, things still might go wrong. But if you know what you're doing, you can, and the error rates are low enough to start with, you can arrange that the probability of error on an encoded qubit is much lower than it would have been if you hadn't encoded it. So that's how you win. Okay, so I've put this in a communications context, but what we're really interested in today is computation. So how do we do computation in a way that's protected against errors? Well, error correcting code is not going to be enough. This picture assumes that Alice and Bob both have perfect quantum computers. Alice has to do some quantum computation to encode the qubits that she's sending, and Bob has to do one to decode it. Moreover, the qubit that Bob gets out is just the same one as Alice sent. And if we want to do computation, we want to figure out how to do gates on qubits while they're still encoded in this quantum error correcting code. I mean, you know, we could decode them and do the gate and then re-encode them, but then if the gate goes wrong, we have no protection. Okay, so this is where fault-tolerant protocols come in. And that's, of course, the main topic of this talk. So before I can go into the 21st century developments in fault tolerance, I have to tell you about 20th century developments in fault tolerance. So, of course, the biggest thing that happened is we discovered that quantum error correcting codes are possible and that quantum fault tolerant protocols are possible. And so fault tolerant protocols have a bunch of pieces. They tend to be pretty complicated. So for instance, there's a number of different ways of doing fault-tolerant error correction. So that's kind of Bob's piece in the previous picture, where you stop, you say, okay, I'm going to look to see if there's any errors, correct them, and then go on with my computation. But you don't want to, in the process of doing that, you don't want to create more errors than you fixed. Right? So you have to be careful about how you go about this. And then there's the question of doing gates on the encoded states. And there's a couple of different ways of doing that, which I'll talk about a little later. Transversal gates, magic states. This, of course, is still the 20th century version of this. Okay, and then there's some other interesting things that were discovered in the 20th century. A number of interesting things. So that will show up later in the talk. One of them is the idea of topological fault tolerance. So Kataev proposed that there might be some systems which are kind of naturally fault tolerant, because they have anionic excitations which do kind of their quantum gates using some topological effect. And it turns out that the topological quantum error correcting code that Kataev came up with as an example of this turns out to actually be very useful for fault tolerant quantum circuits. So that we'll talk about later too. And the other thing, which is the other kind of major result of 20th century fault tolerance, is the threshold theorem. And the threshold theorem is really what tells you that a quantum computer is possible in principle. It says that if you can get the error rate per gate or per time step below some threshold value, then arbitrarily long quantum computation is possible. And bigger computations will require more qubits. I mean, even without error correction, bigger computations generally require more qubits. But there's a blow-up for error correction. And the threshold theorem says that blow-up is not too bad. It's some polynomial in the log of the length of the computation you want to do. Okay? So that's it for 20th century fault tolerance. Now we're ready to take a step into the 21st century. Okay, step. Okay, so this threshold theorem. Yes?
Excuse me.
Going back.
So what's the reason for this, like, intuitively, what's the reason for this threshold value?
Yeah, okay. So the kind of the most straightforward proof of the threshold theorem uses something called concatenated quantum codes. And the idea is pretty simple. So remember I said we have some fault-tolerant protocol. That can be complicated. But when you analyze it, you'll find that the logical error rate, the error rate on the encoded qubits, is lower than it would have been if you hadn't encoded. Okay? So you have some method of taking, you know, some quantum circuit, encoding it to make the error rate lower. And you say, well, if I can do that once, why not take this encoded circuit and encode it again and make the error rate even lower? Okay? And every time you do this, you're making the error rate lower and lower and lower. And actually, it gets lower very, very fast as a double exponential of the number of levels of encoding that you want to do. Now, of course, the size of the computation is blowing up rapidly, too, because each time it increases by some constant factor. And so it's increasing exponentially with the number of levels. But compared to a double exponential, that's nothing. And that's where you get this poly-log overhead. OK? OK. So 21st century fault tolerance. So one of the first things that was kind of done in fault tolerance in the 21st century was nailing down what this threshold value is. In the original computations, if you kind of plug in some numbers to basic circuits and do some estimates, you find an error rate, a threshold error rate of about 10 to the minus 6, one error per 1 million gates. That would you have to go up to an experimentalist and say, that's the error rate you have to hit. Now, that's not totally out of reach. It maybe will reach that someday, but it's pretty hard. And certainly, it'd be much easier for experimentalists if we can get the threshold much higher than that. And so, in fact, we have. So Manny Nil came up with some pretty elaborate procedures involving very complicated ancilla constructions that simulations suggest have a threshold of about 5%, one error per 20 gates. Okay, that's totally achievable. Now, the drawback of these particular constructions is that they have kind of ludicrously high overhead. You need lots and lots of extra qubits, and you try lots of times to make some certain special quantum states, and most of the time you fail. You do some test and you're not sure that they're right, so you throw them away and you try again, you try again, you try again, and eventually you get one that works, and you plug that into your computation. But it shows that the threshold value itself can be quite high, and that it's kind of plausible, and in fact, today has been achieved, that we can get error rates below that. Okay, now one drawback of this is that it's just simulations. And doing a simulation requires that you make some kind of assumptions about the errors. And usually these simulations are done with something called the depolarizing channel, which is just kind of the simplest quantum channel where you say, okay, a qubit goes wrong, and with some probability it's fine, and with some probability just anything happens to it, just totally random. Which is kind of a reasonable thing if you just wanted something to work with, but of course it's not really what happens in the experiment. And moreover, there's simulations, you may not have gotten everything carefully enough, but we've done also rigorous proofs that show that the threshold, again with some assumptions on the error model, is at least 10 to the minus 3, 1 in 1,000 gates, using the same nil procedure. Yeah?
Is that for depolarizing or?
No, that's for kind of stochastic errors, so probabilistic errors, basically independent on separate qubits. Now, again, I said this was not a particularly realistic protocol, but there are much more realistic protocols, specifically ones based on this toric code that I mentioned, and again, I'll talk about it some more later, where simulations suggest that the threshold for them is like about 0.7%, so a little less than 1 in 100 error rate. Okay, so that's a bit more challenging than 5%, but it's still achievable. And there are systems that have gotten error rates below that. Okay, so the other thing we know is that even if you relax these assumptions on error rates a lot, So not only are they not depolarizing channels, but they're not even kind of occurring probabilistically. There can be coherent errors, even non-Markovian errors, where the environment has some memory, it interacts with your quantum computer, it undergoes its internal dynamics, it interacts again a little while later. And so there can be kind of temporal correlations that show up this way. And it turns out that for quite a very, very broad range of non-Markovian systems, we can prove rigorously that there is a threshold. Okay, but the caveat of that is that if you follow these proofs carefully and you say, okay, what is the threshold value that comes out of that proof, it's really bad. Okay, and the reason for that, really bad means like maybe 10 to the minus 10, okay, which is not definitely not achievable in any kind of near future scenario. And so the reason that this number comes out of the proof is that coherent errors can build up very rapidly. So how is that? Well, so a standard example of a coherent error is an over-rotation, right? You want to rotate your qubit, but every time you do that, it goes a little bit too far. Okay? So it goes by some extra angle theta. And suppose you repeatedly rotate the qubit in the same direction. Well, these theta angles build up coherently, right? You're constantly over-rotating by theta. So after one time, it's theta. After two times, it's 2 theta angle. After 3 times, it's 3 theta, and so on. Now, if after one of these gates, you just measure it to see what the probability of error was, well, the Born rule tells you it's order theta squared. Okay? But after 3 times, it's 3 theta squared, or 9 theta squared. After n times, it's n squared theta squared. So the errors are building up quadratically, these coherent errors. In principle, they can build up quadratically. Whereas if you just have probabilistic errors, right, if you say, oh, the probability of error per gate is p, then after n gates, the probability of error is n times p. So they're just adding up linearly. And so that's what accounts for the difference between this 10 to the minus 10 number and the numbers on the previous slide. Well, that's part of what accounts for the difference. It's also a different protocol. Okay, but the thing is, in order to get this coherent buildup of errors that actually is quadratic, everything needs to line up perfectly. So if sometimes you're over-rotating and sometimes you're under-rotating, then now your angle is a random walk. And instead of building up quadratically, you get a square root of that quadratic, and it's back to linear. Okay, random walk is kind of square root of the number of steps. So then there's an important open question. So in a fault-tolerant protocol, you're not just saying, oh, I'm going to do the same gate over and over again. You're actually doing something much more complicated, right? You're doing some fault-tolerant gate, which involves lots of qubits. And then you're interacting with some ancilla, some extra qubits to do quantum error correction. You're doing controlled NOT gates between the computer and the extra qubits. And then you're doing some other fault-tolerant gate, and so on and so forth. And probably, in a lot of circumstances, it's just not possible for the error to build up in this bad, coherent way, because there's too much other stuff going on. So this is a big open question. First of all, is it possible to have this coherent buildup of errors? And second, even if it's possible in principle, is it going to happen in practice? Okay, so this is your first preview of something that has to be answered in the 21st century. Because real systems do have these coherent errors. They do have non-Markovian effects. And if the real threshold is 10 to the minus 10, that would be a problem for building a quantum computer. Okay, so moving on. So sure.
So this would be a systematic error, right? That it's always there. Whenever you do an experiment, you have a little bit of...
Yeah, I mean, right. So this particular example of over-rotating is a systematic error. Non-Markovian doesn't have to be systematic. Your environment just has some memory in it, right? The same qubits kind of, the same environment atoms just kind of stick around.
But in particular, if it's systematic, it leads to this kind of error. So I'm a bit confused. I thought systematic errors is something we always have to deal with because we never...
Yeah, so there's a lot of different kinds of systematic errors. Some of them will not be able to add up coherently like this. This particular example can add up coherently like that. in general, you kind of expect that random errors will not add up like this, because but in principle they could, right? I mean, it could be, again, you have an environment qubit that just kind of always is doing the same interaction with the system, and given enough time, it'll build up coherently.
But lenses and so on, and they tilt things, don't they typically always have a little bit of error like this? No.
Look, so this type of error is a real thing that happens in systems.
Right.
Now, I guess one thing that's worth saying is that this type of error can also be more easily detected than regular errors, because it's always there, right? Systematic errors are always there. You're always seeing them. If you look for them, you'll see them, and you'll be able to get rid of them. Whereas interaction with the environment is kind of a little bit more intractable in that sense. And there's actually other techniques, which I'm not going to talk about, to deal with this specific kind of error that's kind of always the same. but let's assume that we've done all of that stuff. There's still going to be a little bit of this. And the question is it going to add up really fast or not? If it adds up slowly, like other kinds of errors, then that's fine. The error correcting, the fault-tolerant protocol will deal with it, just like it deals with everything else. If it adds up fast, well, the fault-tolerant protocol will still try to deal with it, but it will do less well. Okay, so we'd have to get these things down really small then. Okay, so moving on. So I've mentioned a couple of times the Tor code topological fault tolerance. So this has kind of emerged in the past decade or so as one of the leading candidates for building a big quantum computer, big fault tolerant quantum computer. So again, I'm not going to go into any details about how it works. But the basic idea is that you have your quantum error correcting code, which is kind of simulating a topologically ordered system, so that quantum information is stored non-locally on it. So in particular, one way that people are talking about doing this, one of the main ways, is you'll have some plane qubits arranged in two dimensions, and they have some kind of local constraints that force them into the right state. And then there'll be some big holes in this plane, defects. And defects are associated with qubits. So we'll have maybe qubits stored in a pair of defects. So if you know the circle is the missing circle is big enough and the two circles stay far enough apart, that's a well-protected qubit. And then to do quantum gates, what we do mostly is we move these defects around each other. Okay, we change our local constraints to cause the defects to move. And when one loops around another, you have a topological effect, and that causes a quantum gate. Okay? And because these defects never get very close to each other, you always have protection against errors. You always have a kind of a good quantum error correcting code. And so at the end of the day, you get back to the same locations, but the internal state has changed in a controllable, reliable way. Okay? Okay. So another thing that's been a recent focus of a lot of work on fault tolerance is different kinds of fault-tolerant gate constructions. So I just kind of described to you one particular type of gate construction that shows up in the Tor code. Another type that's popular in other kinds of quantum error correcting codes is transversal gates. So the big challenge in designing any kind of fault-tolerant quantum gate is to avoid error propagation. So what's error propagation? Well, anytime two qubits interact, well, first of all, the interaction itself might cause errors on both of those qubits. But moreover, even if the interaction is done in the right way, it does exactly the right thing, if there's an error on one of them, it might get spread to the other qubit. Okay? The error can propagate. Okay? And so if you try to do your gate, your quantum gate, by interacting lots of different qubits, and there's an error right at the beginning, that error can spread to one qubit and another qubit and another qubit and another qubit. And before you know it, you have lots of errors, and you're unable to deal with this situation. Right? Your error correcting code is designed to correct a small number of errors. When you have lots of errors, you're in trouble. So one kind of simplest solution to this is something called transversal gates, where basically you take the qubits from one block of your quantum error correcting code and line them up with another block of a quantum error correcting code and only interact them kind of in a very constrained way. And so the errors can spread, but they can spread in a very limited way. It's kind of a quarantine procedure to prevent them from infecting your whole computer. But the problem is that we know it's not possible to get a universal set of quantum gates just with transversal gates. Okay, we're always going to need to do something else. Now, the braiding constructions that I showed you on the previous slide, if you have a sufficiently complicated system with non-abelian anions, that does get a universal set of quantum gates. But the problem is those systems are much harder to build, to analyze, to deal with. And in the toric code, the braiding is not sufficient to get universal. So in both cases, you need to do something more. You need a more complicated gate construction to get you all the way there. So the first solution, which actually is really still about 20th century fault tolerance, is the idea of magic states. So here's a way to explain how magic states work. So they're related to quantum teleportation. So here's a circuit for quantum teleportation. So up here is Alice. Alice has some qubit that she wants to send to Bob, who's on the bottom line. And they share this entangled state, 0, 0, plus 1, 1. Alice has one qubit of it. Bob has the other. Alice takes the qubit that she wants to send and her half of the entangled state and makes some entangled measurement, a Bell measurement. She gets two classical bits. She sends these to Bob. And then depending on the value of these two classical bits, Bob does some Pauli operator. And what he gets out at this point, sorry, at this point, is Alice's qubit. But we're interested in computation. So suppose that at this point, Bob said, OK, now I'm going to do a quantum gate U. Then what he gets out is not, of course, psi, but U psi. OK, so that's teleportation plus a quantum gate. What's that relating to magic states? Well, suppose Bob was impatient. He wants to do U, but he doesn't want to wait for these classical bits from Alice. So he does some earlier. He does U earlier. He takes his qubit from the entangled state, and he does U. Well, he's allowed to do that. But the problem is that then he receives these classical bits from Alice, and he was supposed to do a Pauli operator. He says, oh, well, I was supposed to do it here, but it's too late to do that. So instead, I have to do not P's, not the Pauli P, but some other unitary, UP, U dagger. And it turns out that if you've picked U carefully, UP, U dagger is something that's simpler than doing U. So this is the relevance to computation. So this part maybe is something that we can do transversally or do with some other kind of easy gate construction. And this part that involves U, U is a hard gate, a gate that we don't know how to do fault tolerantly. So what we're going to do is we're going to do it on this particular quantum state. And that state, that special state, kind of has U built into it. It's called the magic state. And then once we have that magic state, we can use this teleportation circuit to kind of switch U onto the qubit. It's like that movie The Fly, right, where there's a teleporter, and Jeff Goldblum goes through the teleporter, but his DNA gets mixed with the fly's DNA, and he kind of turns into some half-fly, half-human creature. So this is not horror anymore. We're taking advantage of this effect to teleport through a weird quantum state and get out a qubit that has a gate performed on it. Okay? So the thing is that we haven't eliminated the need to do U, right? We've just kind of pushed it into making this magic state. Right? So we haven't really solved the problem yet, but we've kind of broken it down into a simpler thing that's isolated from the rest of the computer. How do we make this magic state? And in particular, we have to make that state encoded in the quantum error correcting code. And we want to do that in a way that's reliable, even though there's errors occurring in whatever circuits we're doing. And so this is the idea of magic state distillation, which is a 21st century invention of Bravi and Kitaev. So the idea of magic state distillation is you're going to try and make a bunch of different magic states. Okay? And some of them are going to be right, and some of them are going to be wrong. Okay? Hopefully most of them are right, but a few of them will be wrong. And a priori, you don't know which ones are good and which ones are bad. But by comparing them against each other, doing some other quantum circuit, you can figure out if, well, it depends on exactly how the procedure works. You can either figure out that this batch is unreliable, let's throw it out, or this batch is good, let's keep one. Okay? But the whole thing kind of boils down these multiple different attempts at the magic state into one much more concentrated magic state, right? It's distilled out the best part of the magic state. And then there's a lot of junk that comes out. Many qubits where you tried and failed, or even you just used them to test and perfect this magic state and had to throw them out. So you know, you can already see that we're kind of making some progress. So this is enough to make universal fault-tolerant quantum propagation possible, along with transversal gates for the braiding for the Torah code. You need some form of magic state distillation. We'll do it. And you can see that we're kind of making some kind of technological progress. Before, qubits were kind of hand-produced, and quantum error correcting codes hand-produced. You had to make these magic states carefully and, you know, study them very carefully to do things. Now we have factories that will, you know, chug out mass-produced ancillas and, you know, send them off to be used in quantum computations around the world. So we're moving kind of into the industrial era of fault-tolerant quantum computation. Okay, so but magic state distillation is still a pretty inefficient procedure, right? You have to put in lots of magic states and only get a few out. And so there's been a lot of research in the past few years of ways of getting around this problem. So one approach that you can do is try to improve magic states. Magic state procedures are a little bit mysterious. We just kind of happened upon them, maybe not by chance, but a lot of them is kind of mysterious why they work. And so we need a better understanding of magic state procedures and the gates that are used in magic states. And I think there's a lot of probably interesting mathematics tied into this. And one thing that I've worked on and some others is trying to set bounds on the performance of magic state distillation procedures. How good should we be trying to get with these magic state distillation by making a resource theory of magic, quantifying the amount of magic in these magic states. How much quantumness is there that will let us do computations? And then there's a bunch of people in recent years that have come up with various kinds of alternatives to magic states, other kinds of gate constructions that don't use these magic states and can potentially be less costly. Now the problem with these things is that they have different, there's some trade-off, right? Like they use different error-correcting codes which are not as good as the ones we wanted to use before. Or they have their own kind of resource cost associated with them. Or maybe the threshold error rate that they work at is less good. And so, you know, to fully understand what's the best way to do this, we need kind of a comprehensive analysis of these protocols. And there doesn't have to be a single answer that's always the best, right? It can be, in this kind of protocol, you want to use magic states. But in this kind of protocol, you want to use code switching or concatenation or something else. Okay, so that's, again, something that's in progress. Okay, so maybe I should stop since there's been questions after a lot of the previous ones. So this is enough about gate constructions and magic states, and then I'm going to move on to a different topic. Okay, so the next topic, something that's, I think, coming up in the next few years is experimental fault tolerance. So quantum error correction has been demonstrated in a bunch of experiments over the years. So that's kind of early 20th, first century fault tolerant quantum computation, except it's not fault tolerant, right? It's just error correction. So there, you kind of don't worry about errors in the encoding. You make the encoding, then you let it sit around for a while, and then you decode it. And you can see that, yes, the error rate is better if it sits around a long time, but only if, you know, it sits around for long enough that the errors in the intermediate part or overwhelming the errors in the encoding and the decoding, because you're not doing anything about that. So what's next is a full fault-tolerant protocol, where all the parts of the protocol are fault-tolerant. And the error rates in experiments have kind of recently gotten down to the stage, and people are able to build enough qubits that it should be possible to do these experiments. And there's a lot of groups, different groups, working towards doing that. And so in a paper that should be coming out tonight, I've kind of analyzed what these small experiments, in my opinion, should do. And in particular, one question, which I think people have not been approaching correctly, is what is the smallest fault-tolerant experiment you can do? A lot of people are looking at this toric code because it's good for scaling up. But it's not so good for the smallest experiment. The smallest experiment, I think, can be done with 5 qubits using just a 4-qubit error detecting code. So this is going to be a post-selected protocol where you run it, you see if you detect an error, then you throw it out, and you say, conditioned on not detecting an error, how good did I do? Okay? So that's not something that you can scale up, but it's really convenient for a small experiment. And all you need is these 5 qubits arranged in a ring. So they talk to each other around the ring. So the other thing that's kind of important to understand for these experiments is, OK, so you do your experiment, but how do you really show that you have a fault-tolerant protocol? OK, and this turns out to be a surprisingly subtle question. Normally, when we think about fault tolerance, it's in the context of large systems, where there's a dramatic difference between, you know, something that's totally wrong and something that's almost perfect. But in a small experiment, it's not going to be like that. You're hoping to see some improvement in the error rates, but, you know, depending on exactly which circuit you do, maybe sometimes you'll see an improvement and sometimes you won't. So the other thing I do in this paper is kind of spell out a criterion for what would constitute a successful experiment. And the basic idea of that criterion is, well, sort of obvious and sort of not. So the part that seems obvious is you say, OK, I take the encoded circuit that I've encoded using this quantum error correcting code, and I compare it to an unencoded circuit for the same circuit. What's the error rate? Now, the first thing is that you need to compare the error rate in the same hardware, right? Because if you take a small system with one qubit and you do an experiment in there and compare it to a fault-tolerant experiment in 5 qubits, that's not really a fair comparison. They're different systems. They might have different error rates. So you do it in the same system. You compare an unencoded circuit in this 5-qubit system versus an encoded circuit. And you say, is the error rate lower? But moreover, it shouldn't be lower just for one particular circuit. Because you might have gotten lucky. That might have been a circuit where the whatever protocol you did kind of worked well. It needs to work for a wide range of circuits, circuits in some family. And so the criterion that I propose is that if you can get it to work for all circuits in the family, and probably you're not going to test all the circuits, but if you do some sampling that's sufficiently convincing, maybe you can convince yourself and others that it would have worked for any circuit in the family. Then you can say you've done a fault-tolerant experiment. OK, David, you happy with that?
Almost.
OK. Okay, so the thing that I find really exciting about this area of fault-tolerant experiments is that, well, normally in quantum computation, the experiments that people do are kind of really demonstrations. You're saying, look, I can do this quantum protocol. But we know what the quantum protocol is going to do. I mean, the theory is behind it is very simple. We can analyze it. We say, this is what it's going to do. And what you're showing in the experiment is not, you know, factoring works on a quantum computer. We're showing that we have sufficient control over our system that we can do this algorithm. Okay? But fault-tolerant experiments are different. They really can be experiments. Okay? Maybe not the first ones, because, you know, with 5 qubits you can do some simulation, classical simulation, that will tell you what's going to happen. But in the medium term, longer term, when we get up to 40 physical qubits, that's something that's hard to simulate classically. And so we don't know exactly what's going to happen. And moreover, what's special about fault-tolerant experiments is that the errors in the experiment are what you're interested in, right? And so in particular, fault-tolerant experiments have an opportunity to tell us how fault-tolerant protocols interact with real experimental errors, okay? Which we can try to characterize them as best we can, but we can never know everything about them, okay? And so, for instance, there's some people out there who think it's never going to be possible to build a quantum computer, even in principle, because there's some kind of hidden large-scale correlated errors that will only show up in a big quantum computer. Okay? And as you scale up your fault-tolerant experiments, we can maybe convince a few of such people that's not true. Now, I personally don't believe that at all. I think that's very unlikely. But it's definitely true that given any given system, for any particular system, it's not immediately clear if the error rate is good enough to scale up to a big quantum computer. And a small fault-tolerant experiment seems like a really good way to find that out. Yeah?
A thought occurred to me just now. These people who think you're going to have these hidden long-range errors, there's a limit to how strongly they can make that argument before they run into Lee-Robinson bounds, right? If their argument for these mysterious errors would require an error that beats Lee-Robinson, then you can say that it can't happen.
Well, this probably deserves more extensive discussion offline. A lot of these things are not based on kind of a really rigorous concrete argument. They're just like, I think this is what's going to happen. So it's hard to rebut that in a convincing way. So the other thing that's exciting is, remember I mentioned this open question about how do coherent errors and non-Markovian errors, what's the real threshold for them in a fault-tolerant protocol? Well, so an experiment can't totally answer that question. It can't tell you if there's some weird coherent error model that happens to cause a really bad threshold. But it can answer the question of the coherent errors that appear in real experimental systems and non-Markovian experimental errors that occur in real systems. Will they cause this rapid buildup of errors, or will they be more in line with the kind of the regular threshold that we get out of simulations with the polarizing channel? Okay? And that's a really pressing question, because again, it tells us whether quantum computation is out of reach, whether we have to work really, really hard to get really, really low error rates, or whether we're kind of almost there in terms of the error rates we need, and it's now just a matter of scaling up. So all of this is still to be done, but it seems very promising and could open up a lot of new information about fault tolerance and about quantum computing. So one particular theoretical question that I would like to answer, but haven't been able to so far, is what's the best way to kind of extract information about the errors from the experiments? So remember, supposing that there will be some errors, like the depolarizing errors, where the fault-tolerant protocol is designed to handle them, it does it pretty well. Okay? And so we would like to know how much of that kind of error there is in the system. But we'd also like to say, well, okay, but there's also some other kinds of correlated errors and these coherent errors that build up very rapidly. How much of that is in the system? You know, maybe the fault-tolerant protocol will deal with them, but it won't do it as well. Okay, so there's kind of these two components, and it would be nice to be able to do this experiment and say, okay, in this system, we have, you know, 0.1% of, you know, the good error type and 0.001% of the bad error type. And therefore, we're happy to continue in the system. Or say, oh, but we have 0.1% of error, but it's all of this bad type. And so that's going to cause problems for fault tolerance. So that's, I would like to be able to kind of separate those out and tell experimentalists, here's the measurement you should do to get those numbers. But I don't know how to do that yet. OK, so any questions on this topic?
Do you have to, in order to be confident, do you have to keep testing bigger and bigger systems? Or is there some number of physical qubits
For this criterion for the small experiments, mm-hmm. you fix the number of physical qubits.
Okay.
And the reason you have to do that is scaling up is kind of a dicey thing, right? Because Well, first of all, you take a different system, you put in more qubits, they cause more interactions, they might cause more errors. So when you're trying to compare between systems with different number of physical qubits, it's not a totally reliable comparison. You can maybe, if you tried for a couple of different sizes and it's kind of continuing to work, then maybe you can be confident, but that's further in the future. It hasn't even been done for one size yet.
Okay.
Now, in principle, you should be doing it for different lengths of computation with those same number of physical qubits. With quantum error detecting code, that's not really viable because the probability of success decreases very rapidly. But you should try for a range of lengths, but you kind of have to cut it off. And of course, any real system, you're going to have to cut it off too. You should do it for long enough that what you'd like to do is to do it for long enough that you think that, you know, long-term non-Markovian effects are not such a big issue anymore, that you're confident you've handled those. Anything else? Okay, so last topic. So one theme that maybe you've seen repeated so far is that qubits are expensive, right? I mean, in this, I said, let's try to make the smallest fault-tolerant experiment we can do, 5 qubits. People have bigger quantum computers than that, like 10, 15 qubits. But you know, each qubit costs a lot. And you know, even that toric code, which is, like I said, the kind of leading candidate for right now for big fault-tolerant architecture, that has a big block of qubits because, you know, these defects had to be a certain size and they had to be a certain distance apart. And so, you know, you have 100 or 1,000 qubits, physical qubits, for every logical qubit. Okay, maybe more. And so that's a big cost of saying, well, if we get a 100-qubit quantum computer, then maybe we can have one logical qubit and do something that nobody cares about. Because with one logical qubit, we could just easily simulate that on a classical computer. So what we'd really like to do is get that overhead down, right? Reduce the ratio of physical qubits to logical qubits. But you know, do we know if this is even possible or not? How low could we make that overhead? And the answer is, as small as we want. Okay? In principle. There's a lot of fine print in this particular advertisement. But the idea is to take a page from the communication theory. So if you look at channel capacity, which is the communications problem. Alice wants to send qubits to Bob, and again, she wants to save qubits. Okay, she wants to do it with as few extra qubits as possible, but still dealing with some constant error rate. And it turns out that in large systems, you can do this. You can figure out we don't know how to calculate the capacity of a quantum channel, but you can calculate the capacity of a classical channel, and we know that there is a capacity of a quantum channel, where you can say, okay, I can send qubits at a constant rate, and the overhead, the number of extra qubits, or the ratio of physical qubits to logical qubits, stays constant even in really big systems, right, where there's many possibilities for error. So there exist quantum error correcting codes that have these properties, okay, that correct, you know, a constant fraction of qubits and of errors, and still have a good rate of logical qubits to physical qubits. But the problem is that you can't just take this quantum error correcting code and make a fault-tolerant protocol out of it, because you have to do all of this fault-tolerant quantum gates and fault-tolerant quantum error correction and stuff like that. And that requires extra qubits. And for just an arbitrary quantum error correcting code, it's going to require a lot of extra qubits. Okay? But what I was able to show is that if you use the right kind of quantum error correcting code, called an LDPC code, then you can do it. And then you can get this overhead to be a small constant. So what's an LDPC code? So LDPC stands for low density parity check. And an LDPC code is a code where it's defined by a number of constraints on the qubits. And each constraint only involves a small number of qubits. Okay? And moreover, each qubit only appears in a small number of constraints. So in fact, these surface codes, these Tor codes that I've been mentioning for a while now, are examples of LDPC codes. The thing is that surface codes are LDPC codes that do not have a good rate. They have a low ratio of logical qubits to physical qubits. And that ratio gets even lower as you have to deal with bigger and bigger systems to get more and more error tolerance. But there are known to be some examples of LDPC codes that don't have that property. that can correct errors, kind of typical errors that occur with some constant probability. And yet still encode a good ratio of logical qubits to physical qubits. And so we have to find such codes, and we have to come up with fault-tolerant protocols that work with them. So I've shown in principle that such protocols exist, but they're still kind of complicated. So one family of codes that works this way is you take these classical LDPC codes, so classical codes built on the same principles, and you can take two of them and kind of convert them into a quantum code that works the same way. Another interesting example is surface codes, but instead of just doing it on a plane, you do it on a hyperbolic surface, a multiply connected hyperbolic surface. And it turns out there exists weird, interesting hyperbolic surfaces. So in a surface code, kind of every topologically non-trivial loop can correspond to a qubit. And you can come up with weird hyperbolic surfaces that have many, many loops, but it's still a long way around each loop. Okay. The problem is that neither of these families is exactly perfect. So the hypergraph product codes, they can encode lots of qubits, they can correct lots of errors, but we don't actually know how to decode them in an efficient way. I should say it's the classical part that we're having problems with there. The hyperbolic surface codes, well, they're OK for decoding. And in 4D, they're actually really good for decoding. But the problem is that they're kind of only marginal for correcting errors. They do correct kind of randomly occurring errors, but not that well. Okay, so they're not going to be very good in terms of, say, error rate, threshold error rate. So that's one thing that needs to be done to make this a practical result, is to come up with better codes that can solve these problems. The other thing that needs to be done is we need to come up with smaller codes. This result of the overhead is constant is only in the asymptotic limit of huge computations. Okay, and so there's lots of extra qubits that are involved in my constructions, and it's just that in the limit of a huge computation, these extra qubits don't grow very fast, and so they're kind of negligible in comparison to the code part. But in a small computation, which is what we have in the near future, they're really important. So we need to come up with smaller codes and better protocols that will let us do this in the near future. Okay, so that was the last topic. So now let me say, I've already said a little bit about what I think is coming for later in the 21st century, but those are all near future things, problems I can see right now that we could solve. So now let's dream. What will happen in the more distant future? So actually there's a whole realm of work which I hadn't discussed at all, which is the application of quantum error correcting codes to other areas of physics. I mentioned the connection between the Tor code and topologically ordered systems. So that's the connection with condensed matter. One thing that's happened in the last few years is quantum error correcting codes have turned out to be useful in studying ADS-CFT. Or at least some people have been using them. Whether it's useful or not, I guess, is a matter of opinion. So that's just error correcting codes, but maybe some of these fault tolerance ideas can be applicable there as well. But in terms of the goal of building a quantum computer, we want to come up with better fault tolerant protocols. So in my mind, we don't know that the perfect fault-tolerant protocol doesn't exist out there somewhere in the realm of theory, that we just haven't come up with it yet. So this would be a protocol that had much better quantum error correcting codes, that lets us use qubits at a good rate, but also is as good at decoding and is really good at correcting errors. And then better fault-tolerant gate constructions that will let us use these perfect codes to do fault-tolerant gates without much in the way of extra qubits either, or extra time. And since we're dreaming, I'd also like to do this with some minimal connectivity. I mean, hyperbolic surface codes, they're very, very elegant mathematically, but hyperbolic surfaces are kind of hard to work with in the lab. So we'd really like to do this in something that can be laid out on a 2D chip. If worse comes to worse, a 3D arrangement would work too, but that's much harder already. And again, in the realm of dreams, although some of this will certainly happen, is more experimental progress. The error rates we have now are kind of just low enough that we can start to talk about these fault-tolerant protocols, but it would help if they could get, you know, down another order of magnitude or so, down to, say, 10 to the minus 4. That gives you a lot more room to play with different kinds of fault-tolerant protocols, start to use some of these ideas about more efficient codes, stuff like that. It would be really nice to figure out how to extract out of these experimental systems information about how, you know, what kinds of errors are going on and how they're interacting with these fault-tolerant protocols. And finally, to get to the last stage, if we want to move from the industrial age of quantum computing to the quantum information age, then we need really the large-scale working fault-tolerant quantum computer. And hopefully, in the 21st century, we can dream that will happen. Thanks.
So, any questions? Let's start with the Psi. Non-Psi
students. Or non-Psi non-students. Or non-students as well.
Non-everything.
Yeah?
Could you say a bit more about difficulties with more exotic types of anions? Apart from the obvious one of we can't make them in the lab yet, or we don't know how to.
Actually,
anions have their own issues.
Yeah, okay. So one of Kitaev's original ideas about fault tolerance was that we wouldn't have to do all this circuit junk, that we could find or build some quantum system which kind of naturally had fault tolerance because it had anions in it. So the experimental effort to find systems that have anions, well, probably there are physical systems that have anions in them, but they're kind of rare and delicate and really hard to manipulate. So it's possible there could be some experimental breakthrough there. That would be great, but it hasn't happened so far. Now, another approach you could do is come up with some quantum error correction code, which basically had anionic excitations, in much the same way that people talk about using the surface code now. And there's a whole range of issues that have to be dealt with there. That's certainly a viable approach. That would be an alternative code procedure. I don't think anyone has really analyzed how to do that and what the costs would be and what the error rates would be. But it's definitely a possibility. It doesn't solve this overhead problem, because you'll still have to have the anions kind of big and far apart in order to let your error correction kick in. Yeah?
So if I look at your middle point under experimental progress,
yeah,
you know, given a quantum computer, a small one, or just a little gadget that does error correction, maybe you don't want to know everything about the errors. You just want to know some class of problems.
I agree completely. That was kind of it's back a few slides. This is personally what I want to know. Okay, which is lumping huge classes of errors together. And of course, trying to completely analyze your errors for a big experimental system, that's crazy. You don't want to have to do that.
Right.
You want to know kind of the important parameters that tell you something interesting. And to me, these are the important parameters, but it could be that those are not the right ones. So the question then is, what are the important parameters and how do we find them?
So with your 5 qubits.
Yeah.
Geez. then I wonder if there isn't some way of, you know, extracting correlations or of looking at not other non-Markovian. You could imagine an interferometer where you have two of these.
Right.
And you're beating them against each other, or you're. I don't know what the right is, but.
There's
a set of questions we don't have.
Yeah, so there's kind of definitely a range of things you can do, and they will tell you different things about the errors. The problem is getting that information out. You just have, the only thing that you really have in these experiments is, well, I did this circuit, I got this error rate. And it actually, you have a little bit more than that because you say, oh, I detected some errors. What errors did I detect? So that's kind of all you have, and you have to take that data and figure out what's going on, and not in detail. You don't want to figure out in detail what's going on the physical level, but you want to kind of lump it together in this particular way. And so that's what I was so far unable to figure out.
Any other comment or questions?
Yeah.
You were sort of describing the experimental test, and you said you have to do it over some large number of gates. Do you have some more specific technical way of describing what's enough gates?
Well, the short answer is no. So the longer answer is, in my paper, I said, well, OK, I don't know, maybe 10 or 100 gates. Just because, again, in the particular experiment I'm talking about, you can't do repeated error detection, you kind of only do it once at the end. And so if you do too many gates, the error rate build up to too high. So you need lower and lower error rates to do longer and longer circuits, which is not desirable. But for demonstration, I think it's OK. But in long term, it's no good. In kind of future generations of this experiment, where you do repeated error correction, and so you don't have to worry about kind of the probability of detecting an error and then saying, forget it. I mean, there's kind of various time scales in your system. And I mean, there's always going to be very long time scales. But at some point, you say, these are the time scales that I'm most worried about. Let's do something longer than that. That's kind of the right answer, I think. But this is not a universal thing. It's just you have to know something about your system to know what that time scale is.
So there's how many gates you have in the sense of how long your computation is, but there's also how many different types of gates you try.
Yeah, so that's something that I do address a bit in the paper. So remember there's this family of circuits that is supposed to work for everything in this family.
Okay.
And let's say the family runs up to this time cutoff that we just discussed. Still, there's a huge number of circuits that can be done in that range, and you don't want to try them all. So you could kind of try some random circuits. You could try a bunch of non-random circuits, because non-random circuits might see coherent errors build up more.
Right.
And so you need to try kind of a bunch of different ranges of things. And I mean, I'd like to say, you know, OK, this is the list of things you could try. And if you try this, then I'm sure it'll work for all of them. I can't say that.
You can imagine linearity might give you some statement like that or some like that.
Well, no, the problem is that you can come up with weird artificial non-Markovian error models,
right,
which will say, OK, I'm going to wait until we've done this set of gates, and then I'm going to blow up the whole thing.
Right.
OK? And there's just kind of no way to eliminate. I mean, from a totally theoretical approach of no assumptions about the error model, you can't eliminate that sort of thing. So if you want to prove anything rigorous, which I haven't done about that, you'll need to make some kind of assumption about the errors. But you don't want to make an assumption that's not true of your experimental system. So that's a pretty tricky thing, to find something that's true but tractable. But kind of at a plausible level, if you've done kind of a range of things, then that kind of covers all the different possibilities you can think of, then it's reasonable to suppose that things outside that set will continue to work. And you can test that if you wanted, but of course, that doesn't mean that you're testing the right thing.
Okay, so let's thank Daniel again.
Thanks.